Hey, 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 you're listening to First Coast Connect. This is Al Letson coming to you live from Studio 2, sitting in the big chair. How are all you doing today? It is Tuesday. We got past Monday, just a couple more days to go before we get to the glorious Friday. But let's dive in. Today, a discussion about food deserts and their impact on many Duval residents. Then, what you need to know about Peace in Pages, a literary celebration instilled by Gandhi's values. And one local restaurant is lowering the cost of their menu items while food costs rise. But first, Saturday, Winn-Dixie opened the doors to its new College Park location, renewing local residents' access to fresh meats and produce. Like many neighborhoods in Jacksonville, that area of Arlington has long been considered a food desert. This is a step in the right direction, but how do we eliminate these issues that continue to plague parts of the city? Joining me today are Nicole Hamm, Executive Director of the Blue Zones Project. Nicole, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having us.
And Laureen Husband, Vice President of Public Policy and Community Engagement at Feeding Northeast Florida. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Al. Thank you for having me.
And we've got Megan Nimchek, Associate Director of the UNF Center for Nutrition and Food Security, Director of Northeast Florida Hunger Network, and Chief Advisor to Meals on Wings program. How are you, Megan?
I'm great. Thanks so much.
All right. So, Laureen, I'll start with you. Like, can you just give me a definition of what a food desert is?
So the USDA definition of a food desert is an area in urban areas where individuals live more than a mile from a supermarket. And in rural areas, that distance is from 10 miles from a supermarket.
Mm-hmm. And so how prevalent is that in Jacksonville? I mean, Jacksonville is such a huge city. It's so spread out. It feels to me, I don't have any information, that's why I'm asking you, but it feels to me like this could be a big problem in the city.
Yes, at any given time in Jacksonville, we have between 36 to 43 food deserts.
Mm-hmm. Megan, when we talk about food deserts, what do you think the number one thing that listeners who are not in food deserts need to know about them?
So access to fresh, healthy foods is a really vital component to just everyday life. And so it's really important for people to have access to food that is nutritious and delicious and be able to sustain their family healthily.
Yeah. Nicole, how do we fight this?
A lot of it comes down to policy.
Yeah.
How are we encouraging as a local government to incentivize these type of organizations, stores to come into town, but then also even from an asset-based approach, how do we invest in our local corner stores, convenience stores, and markets that are already in some of these neighborhoods so that they are also having the opportunity to sell indirectly to the community healthier, fresh produce and vegetables?
Many, many, many years ago, I was working a lot in Springfield. And I think, you know, prior to working in Springfield, most of the neighborhoods that I lived in Jacksonville were not food deserts. But when I was working in Springfield in the, early 2000s or so, it was just really clear that there was nowhere in that area around where I was working where people could get fresh food. And I think a lot of the population that I was working with also had challenges with transportation. So if they don't have transportation and there isn't a grocery store in the neighborhood. And I think at that time there was one small grocery store that was not very pleasant. It's no longer there. What do you do if you're in that situation?
Going back to my definition of a food desert, I think we need to take time and observe the word. The USDA defines a food desert as an area without a supermarket. So not every neighborhood can support a supermarket, mm-hmm. but most neighborhoods can support a market. So we need to change our thinking about what the capacity of a neighborhood, in terms of purchasing, can they actually support a supermarket based on how much those individuals that live in the neighborhood earn?
And so the difference between the two is like a supermarket would be like what you would consider a Publix or a Winn-Dixie. A market could, as Nicole was saying earlier, could be like a local corner store that has fresh food and produce.
Correct. Something that has a smaller footprint and actually hires local, is not a corporation, is a local business that individuals in that neighborhood can support.
Yeah.
Research is showing us, and historically, look at grocery stores and markets in America. It's only since, like, I believe since the 70s onwards that we've been gravitating to supermarket as models. Most of our neighborhoods have always supported markets, neighborhood markets. You know, you lived in Springfield or you worked in Springfield. I'm sure you remember there's a Superette on Pearl Street that has been there since the 50s. And that's a family-owned business that has existed and lasted through all types of recession, fallouts, in economic fallouts, but the community continues to go there. Neighbors that have lived all over Jacksonville continue to go to that little tiny store that has a very small footprint but has everything you need to prepare a meal today and tomorrow.
What other neighborhoods are you specifically concerned about when it comes to food deserts in Jacksonville?
Well, I think we can explicitly state out east, and the work that Lift Jacks is doing over there with Debs, I think is going to be an incredible improvement to those residents. But I also think about Durkeyville. I think about Brentwood, and Brentwood is kind of in that middle, that weird piece, because they used to have a supermarket. And so that transition can be a little tough. But I think that we just have to be deeply cognizant of the neighborhoods that have historically been underinvested in, because that is where we're continuing to see a lot of the essence of the problems that we're experiencing in Jacksonville. At Blue Zones, we're focused on 5 zip codes in 32206, 32208, 32209, 32210, and 32244. And even by our own data and research, 27% of families are able to have enough money and access to get fresh fruits and produce into their home. So again, we're just really starting to see what underinvestment and what under-incentivization is doing to our communities.
Yeah. Megan, can you talk a little bit about hunger in Northeast Florida?
Certainly. So we have seen traditionally throughout Northeast Florida that some of our communities are really struggling with hunger, and it goes really in line with poverty. And so we've done some research and we've done some programming. The UNF Center for Nutrition and Food Security, the Meals on Wings program, we recycle or we recover food waste and repurpose it and deliver it to low-income homebound seniors. And that's really been a program that's been very successful. But the hardest part with getting food waste to who needs it is obviously the logistics piece of the puzzle. But hunger can reach across all sectors of our community. I know Blue Zones has done a great job with 5 zip codes, but we could find hunger in every single zip code in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah. And Nicole, just tell us a little bit about exactly what Blue Zones does.
Sure. And I'm so glad to be with these two incredible women that I can get to say are colleagues, that we're working together to understand what are the opportunities to create a more sustainable food system. But even now take it to the market level is how do we support those markets in making sure that they have the infrastructure to support fresh produce and meats, i.e. refrigeration is a huge one. But even aesthetics, some people don't go into their local market because it looks like it may not be the best place to be. You know, I was reading an incredible statistic that most people go to Publix because they just think it looks nice, not necessarily for the prices or the experience. It just looks like a better store. So how do we kind of take that into our markets? And then also applying psychology into even the layout of stores. We know that if you place buy one, get one of beer or wine in front of someone that they weren't even thinking about it when they walked in the store, their psychology automatically goes to, this is a deal and I've had a long day and I should grab this. The psychology of maybe having nuts or a charcuterie spread as the first thing that you walk in the door, or you're a deal on fresh fruits or produce, psychology says I should take advantage of that deal. It's the first thing that I see and I'm more inclined to continue my shopping experience based off of the very first thing that I saw in the store.
Yeah. I just want to put on record, I go to Publix for the fried chicken.
Me too.
I'm just
the pup subs.
Right, exactly. I'm just going to be real with it. One thing, so I spent many years in the San Francisco Bay Area. And one thing that I noticed about there that I didn't really see in Jacksonville is that the neighborhood I lived in is pretty walkable. And there are markets probably every three blocks. And each market like would, you know, cater to a specific community. Like there's in the neighborhood that I lived in, there was an Asian market on the corner. There was a market that I would go to the Asian market all the time, but there was a market that I feel like it catered primarily to Eastern European immigrants. And then just a regular market, you know. But they were there and you could literally find three in like a five block area. And in Jacksonville, it doesn't feel that way. It feels like we're very much, and maybe it's because, you know, I feel like in the South, we're very much a car culture. So things are spread out a little bit more.
Yeah, that's correct. I wanted to point out, like, in talking about numerous markets clumped together, a good example is where Fresh Market is in Brooklyn, and they're building a Whole Foods across the street, right? So that in our world is considered a food mirage. So even though they're low-income individuals who live in these neighborhoods, they cannot afford to shop at Fresh Market, and neither can they afford to shop at Whole Foods. So just because there's a grocery store doesn't mean that that is the answer. They also, the store also has to have the right price points and the right culturally relevant food for the population. So you can imagine the frustration of living near Fresh Market and knowing that you can never afford to shop there because your dollars are just not going to stretch like they should for the month.
You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air. First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You know where to look. Just hit us up. Please join the conversation. Yeah, Lorene, just to your point, I was thinking that there definitely is a lot of food in that area, but I don't know. When I was a young man, there was no way I could afford shopping at those places. So how do you correct that? Because there definitely is a community there that needs food, fresh food.
I think that's when I would look to my friend Nicole with that Blue Zones project to say, how can we identify maybe existing corner markets that we can retrofit for the community to be able to bring that produce that they do need? We're also working on zoning as well to start thinking about how many can we have the right language to support farmers markets, farmers market stands all over different neighborhoods so individuals can have at least access to fresh fruits and vegetables. But then, you know, Al, with that also comes to the issue of behavior change. As a culture, we've become a fast food culture. And most people are more gravitate to foods that you can fix quickly, not necessarily foods that are healthy or good for you. We gravitate to what I mostly call processed food, which maybe may look like food, but, you know, my friend Megan would agree with me that, you know, what it's doing to your body is actually much worse than not eating for the most part. But, I'm not going to put that out there. So all nutrition is not the same. And when you use food as medicine, that's when we use fresh fruits and vegetables. Megan.
I think you make a really good point, Lorene, in that the educational component is so important. You know, prior to the pandemic, a lot of food pantries were just giving a bag of groceries when they were able to give out. But then they had moved to a client choice model. And so people could take what they knew and what they were comfortable cooking. And now I think after the pandemic, a lot of times we are going back to the just give out bags of groceries when we can't get to the food pantries and the client choice. So sometimes we need to look really deeply at how are these people using these ingredients. If you're getting an eggplant and you don't know what to do with an eggplant, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to throw it away or are you going to give it to somebody else? Or are you going to be able to find a resource to try and help you use that in the best way you can? I think the education piece with reaching out to our communities and really helping. There has been a lack of education related to cooking. We've lost generations of kids that never got home ec. You know, we didn't teach them to cook. Right now I'm teaching an undergrad cooking elective, and I'm thrilled because we got to start somewhere. We've got to start getting these kids educated with, because if you can cook for yourself, you can cook healthier foods and you can cook on a budget. And I think that's a really important component with all of this, is how can we help educate everybody?
We're going to go to the phones. We've got Stanley on the north side. Stanley, how are you this morning, man?
Good morning to everybody. First of all, there's a difference between a supermarket and a farmer's market. We are talking about farmer's market. Now, when you're talking about it, I've been working on this over 10 years when it comes to farmer's market. The biggest problem in these communities is the community itself. You can develop co-ops. Yes, co-ops, farmer's market in these communities. I have lived all over this country, so I'm not just talking about Jacksonville. In Atlanta, we have that, even though I'm in Jacksonville, but I'm in Atlanta often. But my main point is you have a leadership problem, especially when it comes to social engagement. That's where you develop the farmer's market. Farmer's market is what you need, and that's from within the community. Thank you.
Stanley, thank you so much. I'm a little hesitant to blame the community for not creating these spaces. I think that when we're talking about communities that traditionally, like that, that we traditionally have food deserts in, you're talking about a working class community, and people are just trying to live their lives. They're trying to keep the light bills on, because good Lord, JEA. I think that, like, I agree that it's a leadership issue, but I think it's a leadership issue that we need to be thinking about, not directly at the community, but the government structure of the city. Nicole?
And I think my friend Lorraine will also echo this, is there's a lot of logistics involved that can make things very complicated. If you are a small farmer, you just do not have the capacity to pack up all that you have, go 40 miles down the road, just to hope that you're making more than you just put in, when you can spend your time actually farming and cultivating. So the logistics play a really huge role. And I think that's why sometimes if you're not in the system, you don't realize, because it sounds so great and it makes so much sense, and it really does. But there's a lot of dignity involved and respect that goes into those logistics. And if a farmer is not willing, or they want to prioritize a different harvest or whatever they have going on, there's a level of respect in that. And then also, you know, trucks are expensive, getting a truck to get out there. You know, if I'm in rural Jacksonville and the farmer's market's in Riverside, that's a hike. There's just a lot of logistics that go into that. So I think we just need to be mindful that there are a lot of players in the food system, that while we can't accommodate everybody, we do need to be respectful of how we move forward.
I think, you know, to Stanley's point, because I think the idea of, like, looking at the community and saying, like, okay, so, you know, Durkee Village, it's your fault that we don't have that. I think that that's maybe putting the focus in the wrong place. But there, to Stanley's point, there are some things that local government could be doing to help places like Durkeeville. So not so much putting the onus on the residents, but more putting it on the elected politicians that represent those areas, that they should be enacting some kind of change to make this happen.
100%. There was, and Lorraine, correct me if I'm wrong, there was, they had a market incentive fund that, to the tune of about $3 million at the city level. It sounds like a lot of money, but that's really not a lot of money when you're talking about revitalizing a market or creating a space or helping turn around funds a little bit quicker. We just need to put pressure in our budgets and in our government to say we need to prioritize food access. And a lot of that looks like making sure that dollars show up for that.
Yeah. And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Javon. Javon, how you doing today?
Real good. I think there's a middle point between the big government support and what the, you know, myriad of people are doing. I think that there's an interesting intersection between people who have property, homeowners, or even churches, especially in Jacksonville, that have sometimes huge, essentially empty land outside of their buildings, and companies, small business owners who are wanting to do farming and even help people that want to do their own gardens and help them even sell the extra stuff that they're growing on their property. So there's interesting technology that makes gardening much easier than it used to be. Are there any organizations operating or businesses operating in that space? Like, if I'm a homeowner, is there a local business or, you know, a service that will teach me the ins and outs of how to have my own subsistence garden? But even then, you know, if I have extra, you know, onions or extra tomatoes, they get those to a market where they can be used. Because I'm seeing these things online, but I don't necessarily know how to connect with them. But then how can they be scaled in a way that meets the need in food deserts? And then, you know, when that government dollar does show up, maybe it's somebody with a truck. You know, they don't have to be a farmer, but they can be that connection piece that gets those extra produce to that neighborhood market where it can be sold.
Hey, Javon, thanks so much for calling in. As Javon was talking, the panel was nodding their head. So please, anybody take that one.
So that's where Feeding Northeast Florida would come in. So one of our efforts to support the local food system has led to the creation of another nonprofit, the Just Food Network, which is main mission is to support local food systems activation. And we actually just met with over 30 growers to understand what their issues are and how we can support them to better support their local food system. We also trying to we have committed to use our refrigerator trucks to partner with farmers and growers to get their food, to pick up their food from them to get it to market. And we're in the process of, we're undertaking a project where we will be managing the Beaver Street Farmers Market. You know, we don't have a date yet, but that's coming. And in terms of people wanting to learn how to grow food, Javon or anybody else here, please reach out to me at lhusband@feedingnortheastflorida.org, and I would be glad to connect you with farmers. As well as you talked about churches and the land that they currently have, churches are one of our largest landowners in the country. And we're working with 17 Black churches in Jacksonville through the Black Church Food Security Network to help them grow food. And they also host farmers market on site. They call them soil to sanctuary markets, where they can not only sell to their congregation, but the markets are open to the public.
It's been being in a lot of these community meetings in the food security world, we see each other a lot. And I have to say that watching Dr. Hussband and Feeding Northeast Florida have been really responsive to the needs and finding these farmers and solutions and getting people connected is really, I think, some of the things we're doing really well right now. And so things are in process. Maybe they're not, you know, where we want them to be, but we definitely have really strong people. Nicole, obviously, with the Blue Zones, Lorian with Feeding Northeast Florida, and so many people working together to really get us to where we should be.
There are probably listeners right now who are listening to this conversation and thinking, you know, if they wanted to lobby city council to make some changes to do, you know, something along the lines of like helping ease these food deserts, like what would you be asking them to say to the city councilors?
My main thing is that we really, really, really need a pot of funds to support these already in place markets. They need refrigeration. They need capital to get better credit terms. a lot of these markets, people want them to turn around invoices in 10 days. That's not sustainable when they're waiting on WIC and EBT to turn back stuff around in 30 days. So we really need some support in the middle ground of logistics policy-wise to support these markets. I also think that it is just incredibly important, as Lorene mentioned, zoning. We have got to be so conscientious of what is happening. And I know that there's a lot of energy in downtown, But these are a lot of the work and spaces that we're talking about are sister neighborhoods. Arlington is right over the bridge, you know, from the Matthews Bridge. Mm-hmm. Out East is right by the Sports and Entertainment District. So whatever we do in downtown also will have a spillover effect into these sister neighborhoods. And we need to be careful about what that looks like in terms of zoning, in terms of policy, in terms of how do we even get excess leftovers to organizations and to those that could use it. There's just a lot of things that we need to be asking the question of our city council and elected officials so that they can begin to have those conversations. I would love to see Duval Soil and Water Conservation, come together with city council and UNF and Feeding Northeast Florida and growers and the Black Church Security Network, because I think that there's maybe just an education piece missing, that if we could really see logistically how much there is to do, that everybody could find their space and making sure that we are creating those healthier choices that are sustainable long term.
I think one thing that maybe we don't talk about enough is that good food, good nutrition is actually preventative. Like it helps our healthcare system. Mm-hmm. The more people eat healthy, the more they have access to healthy food. Because I think that to an earlier point that Megan made, that is that, you know, we're in this place now where we're living busy lives. You know, people need to grab and go. And if the only thing around you is a Wendy's, a McDonald's, Burger King or whatever, those choices seem very limited. Like if you don't have a Publix in your neighborhood, but you've got those three things, and we know those three things are in every neighborhood, right? That you end up going there. And that ultimately, I can just tell you from personal experience, when I was young, I could eat a lot of fast food. I am no longer young. I cannot eat. If I eat a lot of fast food, you see it on my body the next day. You know, like, the food baby is real. So yeah, like the idea that like this is like preventative, which also helps us when we're thinking about healthcare on the First Coast, and we're thinking, you know, and I would say that a lot of the population that is in a food desert, they end up in the hospital and maybe uninsured. So it's like trying to look at it from all angles, that like this is an important issue that hits on every single issue that we have in this city.
It is. And, you know, we, for example, partner with our healthcare partners so that they can give food prescriptions to their clients, I mean, their patients, be it at the clinic or hospital level as they're exiting. But that is not the solution. We have to find sustainable solutions where individuals have the autonomy to make the food choices that they would like to make without having to depend on charity or without having to depend on a Wendy's or, you know, one of those fast food restaurants. And the food choices we make today impact our overall health in the long term. And like in some of our neighborhoods, 48% of our kids are going hungry without food. And we can imagine what their productivity looks like in the classroom. And then when they have calories but not high density nutritious food, that also has an impact on their productivity. So yes, we have to do better. And if I was to have a magic wand and ask our city, the thing I would like to see is a department that's focused on fresh food access, dedicated department whose job is to ensure that our city has good fresh food. And if the city cannot do it, maybe to allocate those resources to another organization to make that a priority, because we continue to have this conversation and as if it's you know, a surprise.
Yeah.
But we have to use GIS mapping to, you know, to identify where these gaps are and then make targeted investments. We have to make targeted investments into these communities, and we have to talk to the community about what they like to see there, the choices that they would like to see on those food shelves, because not every store is the same. And when we don't ask the population and we just plop a grocery store in the neighborhood and then say it's failing, when we never really talk to the people about what they would like to buy in that location, then we have failed.
Yeah. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air, First Coast Connect to WJCT.org. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. I'm curious about in Jacksonville, in the United States, the issue isn't that there isn't enough food. There's plenty of food. It just is not getting to people who need it a lot of times. And there's a lot of food waste, like a lot of food that could be, you know, given to populations that don't have access or don't have the money. How is that working in the First Coast?
There's definitely a lot of food waste. I would say we're looking at about 30% food waste. The trick is the logistics. We've had this conversation a lot of times. The getting the food from where it needs to be to where who needs it, and in a short time frame, because obviously we're talking about food,
right.
So that's a perishable item. That is really the turning point. I think when we work together, we do best with this. We have to always think about our partners in the communities. Sometimes we can get caught in our own neighborhood or our own silo and stick with our own what we know and what we're doing. I think when we have our meetings and we talk to each other and we're sharing what we do, we meet with the Blue Zones group, or if I'm meeting with Lorraine at Feeding Northeast Florida and we're talking, that's when we really come up with the best solutions, is when we work together. I also did want to go back a little bit and talk about how, instead of being food secure, what we really want is nutrient secure.
Yeah.
You know, we want people to have the healthy food options and to really figure out what's best for them. If someone is getting discharged from the hospital and you go home and you don't eat properly, you're not going to have successful. You're going to be readmitted, you know, and that's sort of what we're trying to avoid. We want people to successfully rehabilitate. And I will make one other point I want to make sure to make is the social connectedness and the mindfulness around eating. Remember to sit and enjoy the people you're eating with. This is food. It should be fun. It should be family. It should be conversations. Put the phone on silent and just have a conversation with the people. That's what you can do tonight if you really want to think about properly taking care of food.
Yeah. To your point about, you know, when someone is in the hospital, it just made me think about, because diabetes runs in my family. And it just makes me think that, you know, if you are in the hospital for a diabetic issue and then you go home, you specifically, like, the food you eat could determine whether you end up back in the hospital. You know, it's such a big issue. As you were talking about, it just came to my mind that, like, if I did not have I don't have diabetes, but it runs in my family. And I think I don't have it because I've been specifically eating to avoid it. But if I didn't have those options, you know, we'd be having a whole different conversation.
And the fact that you have normalized that to say diabetes runs in my family is problematic, especially if it's the type of diabetes that can be avoided, because we know what you put in your mouth and that the amount of physical activity you engage in determine whether you have type 2 diabetes or not. So how do we change that to where folks who are having that narrative, like, heart disease runs in my family, diabetes runs in my family, we can change that.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to me about food deserts and to the First Coast. Nicole Hamm, Executive Director of Blue Zones Project. Lorraine Husband, Vice President of Public Policy and Community Engagement at Feeding Northeast Florida. And Megan Nimchek, Associate Director of UNF Center for Nutrition and Food Security and Director of Northeast Florida Hunger Network. Thank you all for coming in and having this good conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we will be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in Studio 2 in the big chair. How you doing, Duval? It's a Tuesday. We're getting through it. It's going to be a good week. This Thursday, Read USA is hosting Peace in the Pages. This annual event aims to celebrate literacy and local heroes who are championing the cause. Joining me now, Dr. Rob Kelly, CEO of Read USA. And on the phone is Shelley Reed, best-selling author, educator, and Peace in the Pages keynote speaker. Welcome.
Thank you, Al.
Shelley, you there?
Thank you, Al. All right. I am here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling in. So Rob, tell us exactly Read in the USA. What's the mission of the organization?
So Read USA is an educational nonprofit, and we are focused on solving illiteracy. And we do that through our programming with teaching teenagers how to provide one-to-one literacy instruction to young children having reading difficulties. And then we also provide book fairs so that children have free access to books of their choice, family engagement, multicultural literacy, and then teacher professional development.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I struggled with dyslexia, like really badly. Mm. And they kept trying to get me to read. I remember that. Do you remember the old Dick and Jane books?
Absolutely.
I feel so dated when I say that.
I'm with you. I connect. Shelley, do you remember those?
Oh, yes. I do.
Those books were so boring. I hated them. And so, like, they thought I couldn't read. They gave me a comic book and magic. Like, I learned how to read because, like, they engaged my my imagination and got me into it. So when you say that you guys are looking to give books that at book fairs that kids want to read, I think that's such a huge part of it, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, interest and choice are linked to motivation. And motivation, we usually think of motivation as, you know, the carrot dangling out in front of somebody, but that's short-lived, right? Mm-hmm. If we want long-term internal motivation, then you've got to tap into interest. And how do we do that? By providing choice.
Yep.
Kids choose the books they want to read, they'll read them.
Yep. I still remember being in middle school reading like a big 300-page novel. I remember getting it and I wanted to read the story so bad. And I just had to dive in and I did it. And I did not think I could do it, but I got through it. And it was such a confidence booster. It made me fall in love with books and storytelling and all of that. So you've got the Peace in the Pages event. What is that?
So that's our annual event based around Gandhi's birthday. And we're at our fifth year of doing this. Our board chair, Ellen Wiss, is the one who created this event. And what we want everybody to know and what we're celebrating is that through literacy, we can learn to be more empathetic. We can learn to be more peaceful. We can learn to be a better community through literacy. And that's what we're celebrating.
Yeah, it's first of all, I have to say that your board chair, Ellen Wiss, is a friend of mine and she's amazing. Doesn't surprise me that this idea was born from her. I think the beautiful thing about books is that you can read a book and it can put you in a circumstance and in a place that you never knew before, that you didn't understand. And that creates empathy. It creates like an understanding of what it means to walk in somebody else's shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, Al, when I started reading Shelley's book, Go as a River, it's enchanting. I'm going to give you the book to read.
Yes.
You can't stop reading it. It's amazing. It does that very same thing. Just puts you in and you learn so many lessons from it.
And on that note, that is you, Shelley. Tell me about your book.
Thanks for that, Rob. So my book, it's a novel and it's set on the western slope of Colorado. And it's about a young woman growing up along the banks of the wild Gunnison River before it was evacuated and flooded to create the largest reservoir in Colorado. So it's based in a real piece of actual history. But it's very much a novel around place and displacement, home and family, prejudice and racism. But really, it's about digging into the depths of our strengths and resilience, where we're often so much stronger than we know that we are until it's really put to the test. I think that's probably the takeaway message from my novel.
Yeah, what inspired you to write that?
Oh, well, that's my homeland as well. I'm a fifth generation Coloradoan, so I'm really deeply rooted in place. But in terms of my life experience, I was, a lot of people know me now as an author, but I've been a teacher for the last 30 years. And a lot of what has inspired me about the depth of human strength and resilience has been working with my university students, particularly the program that I founded around working and rising up and lifting up the most at-risk students at our university, which ended up making me a really great fit for Peace in the Pages and to work with Read USA.
And so what are some of the topics that you're going to talk about at Peace in the Pages?
Well, the thing that I love doing with students is just letting them know that somebody believes in them. You know, I mean, you're talking about making sure they get the right books in their hands. I really believe in that as well as an educator. But what I felt like my biggest role was with my students who were accepted to the university, but were coming in flagged as at risk, maybe not having the preparation that they needed to succeed in school, not having ever known anybody who went to college. Usually they're the first in their families to come to college. My job, I felt, was cheerleader more than anything else, to put a safety net under those students, help them gain the skills they needed, but more than anything, just let them know every single day that somebody believed in them and they knew that they could achieve their dream of a college education.
Yeah. Rob, can you give me all the details about the event?
Yeah. So Peace in the Pages is Thursday at 11:30 at the Everbank Stadium Gallagher Club. It is for invited guests only, but we've invited hundreds of people around town, our donors, city leaders, other people in the community who are volunteering with us, and those who are just want to continue this mission of solving illiteracy. And so Melanie Lawson from Channel 4 is our MC, and we've got some great award winners like Kevin Gay from Operation New Hope, Nicole Thomas from Baptist Hospital, Betty Burney. So you won't want to miss it.
All right. You heard it here first. You heard it here first. Peace in the Pages is going on this Thursday. And I've got Shelley Reed, bestselling author, educator, and she'll be in town talking about education and reading and her book. And then Dr. Rob Kelly, CEO of Read USA. Thank you both for coming into the studio and talking to me.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you, Al. So wonderful to talk with you.
All right, and we will be right back after this.
Life South Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with Life South helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you. Amelia Island presents Island Hop Craft Beer Fest, October 7th from noon to 4 p.m. Family fun with craft beer tasting, live music, food trucks, and a Main Street marketplace. Info at ameliaisland.com/islandhop.
WJCT Public Media and the Florida Theater present Benesse, live at the WJCT Soundstage, Tuesday, October 10th at 7:30 p.m. It's one hot night as Benesse, the Prince of Spanish Guitar, and his Emmy Award-winning production come to town as part of his global tour. Armed with his Spanish guitar, Benesse will take the audience on an unprecedented and epic adventure. Tickets and information at wjct.org/events.
Olivia Rodrigo has become known for her confrontational songwriting style, ripe for social media with lyrics that quickly become their own catchphrases. But she doesn't plan it that way.
That's the antithesis of creativity to me. I think it should be for you first and foremost, and that's how the best songs get made.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Rodrigo's new album, Guts, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
Fall has officially arrived, and with it, a flavor you just can't miss, and that many can't stand.
Take a pumpkin spiced cinnamon stick and shove it right up your ass.
It might not be everyone's favorite, but others are, and the spice trade is booming. What does it say about how our tastes are changing? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. In a time when food costs are steadily rising, Bistro X is lowering its prices. Marcello Villani, owner of Bistro X, is here with me today. Listen, Bistro X is in my top three of restaurants in Jacksonville.
Thank you. Go there all the time.
Food's always great. Service is always great. How are you lowering your prices at a time when everything seems to be going up?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. We don't just go after the money from the people. We also want them to experience great food, but not always spending a lot of money. The idea of just having some of the items that they not too expensive, but give them the same quality of Bistro X. That doesn't mean because they pay less, we're gonna, bring down the quality of the food. No, it's not. It's actually the contrary. We're gonna reduce the price, but we're gonna give a better product. We just have to be a little bit more inventive, and we have to pay a little bit more attention how we do things.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to just be here for the money. We're here for the experience of the clients coming in and enjoy Bistro X for real. As an example, we don't have the most expensive items like we used to. Filet mignon, we used to sell at $52. Now we change with New York strip. If you like meats, it's a substitute that's almost like half of the price of the filet mignon.
Question, do you still have the rack of lamb?
Yes, we do.
the rack of lamb is my jam, man. You can't get rid of that.
Yes, we do. Yeah. And is the... The idea of only rich people can have good food, it bothers me, mm-hmm. basically. I want everybody to be able to come in and taste what Bistro X is all about. And not just because I want them to come in so I can make more money. Just to come in, my bank account is people laughing with me and say, I had a great dinner, I had fun, the service was good. That's my bank account.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
So tell me, like, what are some of the items on the menu coming up?
Some of the items on the menu that we took out are the most expensive items, which in reality, it's just cost effective. We don't have any lobster anymore on the menu. We don't have filet mignon. We don't have caviar, we don't have foie gras, but at the same time, we try to keep the items French Mediterranean, which is what we really are. We're not a true French restaurant. We're more of a bistro, which bistro means homey food, food that is supposed to be inexpensive, but good.
Mm-hmm.
That's the name bistro. That's what it means. But a lot of the restaurants here, they put all these expensive stuff on and they think more expensive they are, more French they are, which it doesn't make sense. It's actually the contrary. French bistro is very, very homey.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be inventive with what you give the people. You know, it's like you can take like a little plate of rice and you can make an appetizer of rice balls and... it's so inexpensive that you can sell it for $12, $13, $14.
Yeah.
Well, we do not have an item on the menu, on our menu, more expensive than $35. My price point is lower than a coffee shop down the street from me.
Yeah.
So that is what I'm working with. Also, how I buy things. I have to be very careful. Sometimes I go to the market. Sometimes I go and pick what I like. And I tell the guy, keep giving me this stuff, I set the price, and, you know, we create a friendship, you know?
So can you tell us, for those who don't know, where you're located and hours and stuff like that?
Okay, we are located on San Marco Boulevard, right off the bridge from downtown. We are open Monday to Friday from lunch, 11:30 to 3:30, and dinner Monday to Friday between 4 at 9:30. And Saturday night, we open from 5 to 11. Mm-hmm. Sunday, we are closed the whole day.
And I feel like I've been going to this restaurant for at least a decade now. How long have you been open for?
24 years, almost.
24 years, Bistro X, lowering their prices. It just sounds like a good time. Thank you so much for coming in. Marcello Villani, owner of Bistro X. I'm surprised this is the first time we've met because I've been in your restaurant so many times. It's good food.
You might know my sous chef, which I just said to my friends outside. It's like, he knows more people than I do.
Exactly. And that is our show today. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you had a good time. Our executive producer is music maestro David Luckin. Our producer is Stacy the Brain Bennett. Our associate producer is Kathy Waterman. Our director, our Steven Spielberg of the operation is Brady Corum. I'm gonna like start playing and like his name is Brady Kombucha. Like, I'm just gonna give him a new name every day. Our theme music is performed by Club De Belugas. If you have questions or comments for First Coast Connect, please send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Al Ledson. You've been listening to the show on WJCT News 89.9. And remember, y'all, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. And I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.